By the summer of 1861, Wilmer McLean had had enough. Two great armies were converging on his farm, and what would be the first major battle of the Civil War, Bull Run.
When Ken Burns' documentary, The Civil War, first went to air in 1990, it was a game changer. By ditching reenactment and relying instead on the power of music, narrated journal entries, and thousands upon thousands of still images, Burns created a new type of documentary. In its own way, it was a revolution. And now, 22 years later, some would say the field of documentary making is in another, as digital tools and a do-it-yourself ethos are beginning to transform the genre.
That's some fly mother beast.
Let your voice be heard.
It is one of those things we're going to have to deal with going forward. What is a documentary? And coming from that, what is a documentary maker? Because we all write about ourselves in various ways. We all post images. We all create a narrative about our lives and the things we're passionate about.
What the web is teaching us documentary makers and the culture and language of the web is a democratization of storytelling and the democratization of media in our lives. And so I think the interactivity points to that in terms of our own transformation or reconsideration of the documentary agenda.
With this new stuff, it all feels a little bit rough and ready, I guess. And I think, you know, some of those more gimmicky things have to happen. I think that they are steps along the road. So I'm not dismissive of them by any means, but it is easy, I think, to go for the bright, shiny objects and go, oh, look at that, oh, look at this, and sort of forget a little bit about the craft, I think.
Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome to Future Tense. Now, the changing nature of the documentary process is such a large topic, we can't really hope to explore it all in this one show, but we have a number of issues and perspectives to cover. The idea for this program originally came from listener Kate Nash at the University of Tasmania. So let's start with her.
South Australian Towns, the story of Renmark.
I mean, I guess the great thing about documentary is there isn't really any final arbiter that says this is and this isn't a documentary. A lot of the ideas that we have about documentaries are serious, they deal with, you know, topics that are really important, they make a difference. A lot of these ideas can be traced back to the 1930s and particularly the rhetoric of Grierson and that kind of documentary movement. But I guess we have to take a kind of broader perspective because there is no universal or, you know, definition of documentary that holds for all times. It's like all media, it's constantly in transition.
Is it possible, though, to say what are some of the common features of a documentary, particularly given that in the digital world, of course, there are many different platforms on which a documentary can play or can be created?
Yeah, look, that's right. And I guess one of the ways you can start to approach this is to think about what it is that separates documentary in terms of what it's trying to do within that complex media space. So in terms of its functions, we can start to look at documentary as, you know, recording and representing the real, but also as trying to achieve a certain level of, you know, political impact. Documentaries generally try and convince us that something is true and try and put a particular perspective on a subject matter. And so that's one way of looking at what it is they're doing that separates them. Because, of course, a lot of different media deal with what's true and the real world and all that kind of stuff. So it's just really, really complex. And it's really difficult to draw firm boundaries and barriers around something that is documentary. Certainly if you try and pin it down at the level of, well, what makes a documentary, what makes a documentary text, then it becomes really complicated because a lot of what makes a documentary text has been used in fictional contexts. So a lot of those textual markers like shaky camera work and grainy footage has been used in a lot of fictional forms as well. And when they use that, they're very often referencing that idea that this is somehow true.
In High Rise, what we're trying to do is through a multi-year and many media approach, we're exploring the urbanization of the planet and what it means to live vertically. For most of my life, I've driven by high-rise buildings, almost, I could say, despising them. I lived in one once when I was 5 years old. and didn't like that experience very much. So I spent most of my life driving by these buildings, and it was really through a variety of things that happened that I started looking at them in a different way. So how do humans find in their incredible ways to live out their lives in these boxes? And that became extremely exciting and interesting for me. So that was, on one side, was the content and the subject of the work that we're doing. And on the other side, for 7 years now, I've been working at the National Film Board of Canada to explore new forms of documentary storytelling. Again, high-rise, just like the project I did before at the film board called the Filmmaker in Residence Project at St. Michael's Hospital, I've been mandated to innovate with new forms of storytelling.
Meet Kat Cizek, a leading Canadian documentary maker.
High-rise will put people and process first. We'll harness the tools of the digital revolution. It's a multi-year, multimedia project.
I've always been what I call platform or media agnostic, in the sense that I've never really tied my interest in documentary to a specific media platform. I'm sort of a product of the accessible and affordable digital handycam, or it wasn't digital at the time, but it was the beginnings of the handycam, what I call the handycam revolution. And so for me, I've worked in radio, in print, in video, in audio, I've worked in radio. And so all these tools have always been there for me, and I've always been more interested in how documentary can impact a community and how a community can take hold of its own stories. And so when the web came along, it just became a natural extension of that kind of interventionist work that I was already really, really excited about.
Given there are so many digital tools out there to use now, how do you actually decide which ones are appropriate for, say, a project like HiRISE? Because I guess, you know, just because there are these technologies doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be useful or that they are going to enhance your documentary project, does it?
In fact, it can be quite the opposite. I think sometimes people get so overwhelmed and so overly enthusiastic about the technology, it begins to drive the project. And so what we've tried really to do at HiRISE is to start with the story, start with the research, and then really work on relationships. We have a very sort of unique process at HiRISE and Filmmaker in Residence, the previous project, where we don't start by setting the terms, the technological terms of the project. That comes later. And so I have this incredible freedom that the National Film Board of Canada has afforded me to do documentary in the way that I believe it's meant to be done, which is it's about discovering new ideas, new solutions to old problems. And I find that limiting ourselves by or defining the technology before we've even begun to understand the subject and the emerging issues in a way almost predefines the answers you're gonna come up with. So it's been a really, really incredible process where often I can be working on a project, for example, One Millionth Tower, which is the most recent project that we released a few months ago. It's built entirely in HTML5, which is open source technology. That project went through so many twists and turns as we were working on it and bringing in new partners and new conversations that I was having on the side of it. So it started off as a short video, short film, and turned into a 3D user experience directly in your browser. So it's really about being flexible and nimble. I mean, when we started Filmmaker in Residence 7 years ago, YouTube didn't exist. I mean, our digital realities are changing so dramatically almost on a daily basis that I think doing really deep documentary work, it doesn't really make sense to define it by technology that's hot right now when really, you know, doing deep work takes time. And it might not come out for 6 months or a year or, you know, as HiRISE is happening for several years. So sticking close to the relationships and the story is, I think, what's been very exciting for me as a documentary maker at HiRISE.
And with the documentary projects that you've undertaken, you've aimed to provide the viewer with an interactive component, an interactive snapshot almost of life in parts of Toronto. How important is interactivity in that documentary process for today's audience?
What the web is teaching us documentary makers and the culture and language of the web is a democratization of storytelling and the democratization of media in our lives. And so I think the interactivity points to that in terms of our own transformation or reconsideration of the documentary agenda. You know, I think for so many years, partly because of the technology, but partly because of the times, documentary was a process in which we went somewhere, we sort of collected all these stories, we squirreled away into an editing room, and then, many months or years later, came up with a finished product. And what the democratization of the digital age we live in has allowed us to do is break all that open. So interactivity and participatory, collaborative methods need to kind of infuse the way that we do documentaries, not just as a finished product online or on your mobile device, but it needs to also really, for me, I think as a political act, needs to affect the way that we do our documentaries with the people that are involved in them. So I like to talk about, you know, people formerly known as subjects. I don't think of the people that appear or are heavily centered in the documentary work that I do. I don't think of them as subjects. I think of them as collaborators and participants. We work together in a much more democratic way to tell a story.
Hi, I'm Julie from Swansea in South Wales, United Kingdom. I love my Future Tense podcast because it doesn't just explain the future, it feels as though I could be there.
My dream scenario as a commissioner in that space is that people come to SBS with a multi-platform pitch, that they aren't just thinking about one medium. I don't necessarily think that every story has to be told online. With online content, I think it's really important to ask yourself why it is that you're making it for online. What is the compelling reason? With our projects, we tend to always ask ourselves the question, what is this project doing that television can't do? That tends to be our commissioning position, where we look for a unique reason to make this thing online. They tend to be big time and money investments, and they really have to answer on that compelling reason.
Now, Nick Doherty's job, as you're probably now aware, is to commission documentaries. He's managing editor, Television Online, for the Australian public broadcaster SBS.
It's really horses for courses as to how many platforms the story is told over. Some of the projects that come our way really are pretty much best served just by being television only. We get a lot of pitches for online which are kind of repurposed TV pitches, and for that reason probably don't suit the web. So I think it's really an education process to try and explain to producers why a project might be right for the web, or by the same token might be right for television, or as we say, it might be right for both, the cross-platform. That's a process that's been getting a lot better over the last 2 or 3 years. More and more we've seen the evidence that producers are starting to get a much clearer understanding of what each medium requires.
Is there a desire on the part of producers to try and cover all bases, if you like, to try and make their content multi-platform, regardless of whether it actually fits other platforms?
Yes, I think that is true. I mean, it's very difficult because nobody can really be an expert in everything. So quite often what happens when you look at multi-platform projects is you'll have a television producer who has quite a traditional skill set based in the TV world. And we also work with, you know, web experts that have grown from more of a service industry background. So trying to put those two people together hasn't always been the easiest of relationships. And as a broadcaster, you're kind of in the middle of that relationship and quite often left crossing your fingers and hoping for the best. We've seen some really great executions, and at the same time, we've had things that have run aground through no fault of anyone in particular, other than the fact that this is all very new and a lot of it is commissioned under an R&D kind of remit. And at the end of it, we're all trying to come out with some key learnings that we apply into future projects. So yes, I would say that there is a real willingness to kind of get projects online, but not always kind of complete understanding of why a project should be online. I mean, I think to talk to that for a second, I think a producer that has a strong story and wants to publish it online really needs to ask a few questions at the outset and really answer the key question of why it should be online as opposed to, for example, on television. And, you know, there needs to be a really compelling reason. We quite often look for a compelling technical hook or technological hook. So there needs to be a real intersection between the narrative and the technology to make it a viable web project.
In the heart of Sydney lie 2 acres of land that symbolise struggle, tragedy, community and unity for Indigenous Australia. Born out of the Black Power movement and fuelled by the passion of activists, The block began with a handful of dilapidated houses, a group of reformed alcoholics, and a grant from the Whitlam government.
The block drew Aboriginal. In multi-platform factual projects are sometimes difficult because of the fact you don't really know what you're going to get. Quite often they happen in the edit. They take place over a long period of time. So quite often in television, that isn't necessarily a problem. You can commission a project without really knowing what it's going to become. In online, that gives you a few difficulties. So in the multi-platform world, we've struggled in that sense in terms of factual. If you're making a program for online only, or a producer wishes to publish something on the web, maybe an interactive documentary, you're probably looking for a technological hook in there. And in that sense, from a broadcaster's point of view, we might be looking for things like an innovative use of social media, or we might be looking for an immersive reconstruction. And these are all things that we've managed to achieve in recent projects. And because these are done under an R&D remit, because they're made with innovation funding quite often, there is always a requirement to kind of push things on a little bit each time to apply learnings from previous projects and, I guess, not repeat yourself every time. So as successful as some of these things have been for us, you're always looking for the next thing and the newest thing and something that really warrants it being quite often a 12-month plus investment of resources.
I presume for an online documentary, you'd need to have a theme that's much more tailored, much more specific to an audience. Would that be correct?
Yes, absolutely. With the online-only documentaries, quite often, I mean, especially in an environment like SBS, when we commission those projects, you definitely have an audience in mind at the outset. So unlike the television model, which ultimately you're putting an antenna in the ground and trying to market your message to people in the hope that as many people as possible tune in, with some of the online-only factual projects, it really is about working out where that audience is, who's going to use the product. In some cases, we've even gone as far as publishing the content directly to that audience, perhaps through a Facebook group, allowing them to feedback on the content and share it and really shape the direction of the project in almost like a living documentary form. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It tends to be, particularly in an SBS content, more about high-needs audiences or niche audiences. The projects also play out over a longer period of time. And so that allows us to deliver to a more niche audience that might use the project quite frequently, as opposed to television's model, which is about a lot of people for not very long.
Crowdsourcing is a really, really interesting kind of change to the way documentaries are being made. Up until now, documentaries have been things that governments funded because they were important for us and good for us. And increasingly now, like a lot of media producers, documentary makers are looking to their audiences. And I think that's a really interesting development for documentaries. There's a documentary maker called Jennifer Fox who's most famous for a series of autobiographical documentaries called Flying Confessions of a Free Woman. And actually, over the past 20 years, she's been working on a documentary called My Reincarnation. I haven't seen it yet, but it sounds like a fantastic story about a Tibetan Buddhist master and his son. But she'd been filming for 20 years and she had it pretty much filmed, but didn't have the money for the post-production. And so she turned to Kickstarter and she wanted to raise $50,000 through Kickstarter to finish the film. Well, actually, as it turns out in the end, she raised three times that amount. And so that's become this real sort of sign for a lot of documentary makers, or, you know, of what can be possible in this space. And we've actually seen a couple of Oscar shortlisted documentaries for this year have had some crowdfunding as well. So it is potentially changing even the kind of really big end of town. But of course, what's different about documentary is that crowdfunding raises all these issues about editorial control, because we're seeing filmmakers, and this is quite a complex space because, as you know, documentary has this kind of activist tradition and this, you know, so it's a dilemma. It's a real genuine dilemma here. But you are seeing filmmakers with really, really strong agendas raising money from people who basically agree with them. So you may have seen the documentary Gasland. Well, there's another documentary that basically counters the claims made in that documentary called Frack Nation. And you can Google them and see what they're up to. But they have crowdsourced this documentary, which is about fracking and how it's not an environmental issue. And so they started out with the agenda of actually kind of changing the debate around fracking and were able to successfully tap into, pardon the pun, you know, this community that had a concern with having their voices heard on that issue. So you could look at it as a leveling of the playing field. If you've got, you know, basically the barriers to producing documentary are lowering. But on the other hand, it also means that people with an agenda are able to reach really, really wide audiences. So that's something that I think we're all going to have to come to terms with.
Kate Nash from the University of Tasmania. So far on the show, we've heard from Kate, a documentary academic, Kat Cizek, a leading documentary maker, and Nick Doherty, a documentary commissioner. The next person I want to introduce you to is involved in funding documentaries, of all descriptions. She's Ingrid Kopp, and she's the Director of Digital Initiatives at the Tribeca Film Institute in New York.
Everyone has the sense that there's something happening and that we need to be in the space, but there's a lot of unknowns. And so I think a lot of people are sort of waiting to see kind of what happens. And one of the wonderful things about my job is I get to kind of be in that sandpit trying to figure it out and make it happen. But it's also one of the terrifying things, because sometimes I come into work and I think, oh, okay, what are we going to invent today? And that can be a little unnerving.
So it's very much a work in progress, really, with the changes that we're seeing with documentaries.
Yeah, I think it has to be, because, I mean, of course, there's a history to this, and it's not like this is all happening this year or last year or even in the last few years. I think there's a long history of this, but just with this huge change in technology and everything's moving so quickly, I think the sort of social media revolution of the last, you know, whatever, 7 years, I think it's just sort of tipped us into an environment where we're having to do everything a lot quicker. And just because of the way audiences are changing, you know, traditional mainstream media audiences are changing so fast, I think that's why it suddenly become this sort of, there's so much more interest in this area now, because I think we've all been thrown into it quite quickly. It's difficult, though, because there's such a balance to be struck between, you know, holding true to the parts of documentary storytelling that, you know, make us love documentaries and have made me, it's why I decided to work in documentaries, the craft of it and this long history, but then also being open to experimenting and to trying and failing, which I think is a huge part of this as well. And sometimes balancing those two can be really difficult. And it's definitely something that, you know, I've found quite tricky. And I'm more comfortable with it now, I think. But it's hard, because there is a long history of documentary storytelling and things at work and a whole critical discourse around that. Whereas with this new stuff, it all feels a little bit rough and ready, I guess. And I think, you know, some of those more gimmicky things have to happen. I think that they are steps along the road. So I'm not dismissive of them by any means, but it is easy, I think, to go for the bright, shiny objects and go, oh, look at that, oh, look at this, and sort of forget a little bit about the craft, I think.
Now, what are some of the innovative approaches that you've seen in recent times that have impressed you and other people at the Film Institute?
One of the wonderful things, I think, about where we're at now is that I feel like the sort of silos between disciplines and industries are sort of collapsing, or at least mushing together a little bit more. And so when I'm looking for inspiration, I mean, I definitely look within the sort of the traditional film industry, but I look outside it a lot as well, because I think a lot of the innovation is actually happening outside of what we may have traditionally thought of as, you know, independent film people. So, for example, I'm really inspired by Jonathan Harris, whose most recent project is Cowbird, which allows people to tell stories and upload images. And, you know, I think he comes more from the digital art world. And then I think Chris Milk and Aaron Coblin, who did the Johnny Cash project and before that the Wilderness Downtown, are incredibly innovative in the way that they use the web really creatively. And again, they're not really, you know, they're not coming out of the documentary world. And Star Wars Uncut, which is a project that I always show, which I think people are a bit surprised about, because again, it's not really a documentary, but it's people remixing and redoing Star Wars cut into 15-second segments. So it's really building on this idea of collaboration and remix and audience votes, and it's very open, which I love. So that, you know, those are some projects sort of, I guess, more outside of documentaries. And then within the documentary world, I think the National Film Board of Canada have just done some incredible stuff. I think Kat Cizek's Out My Window is wonderful. I think Bear 71 is probably one of my favorite projects in terms of interactive documentary storytelling of recent years.
From what you're saying there, is it more difficult to definitively say what is a documentary? I mean, some of them obviously will be easy to tell, but is there much more of a blurring about what is a documentary and what isn't?
I feel like maybe it's the industry. You know, I always, with this work, I always try to separate the industry questions from the creative questions, because I think they're often different. You know, I think creatively there's always been lots and lots of arguments and bickerings and, you know, academic papers about what documentaries are and what they aren't. So I think this fits firmly within that. But I guess what is interesting now is that I think what you're seeing is that it's not people who would see themselves as documentary filmmakers who are making documentary projects. I think that's the difference. I think now, you know, everybody who has an iPhone or a phone with a camera, you know, they're recording reality. And so there's just this huge outpouring of footage and of stories. And I think that just necessarily changes, I guess, the way that we, as documentary makers and, you know, documentary industry, I think it just necessarily changes the place that we are situated within.
What then defines a documentary, particularly in a world where there is so much information gathering, so much data gathering, so many photos and videos being taken and uploaded? How do we define what is a documentary?
Million-dollar question. I mean, you know, I try not to answer that because I find it very difficult. I mean, I definitely feel like, for me, the difference between footage and data and documentaries is the crafting of the story. And that can happen in lots and lots of different ways. Obviously, it happens when you're holding the camera in your hand, and then it happens when you're editing a traditional documentary. I think with a lot of this work, it is about a sort of authorial vision. And that, to me, is the difference. But I get a little bit more uncomfortable, I guess, with the sort of professional-amateur differentiation, because I'm not sure that that holds so much anymore, because I think there are a lot of very unprofessional, incredibly skillful and crafted stories out there now. So as part of my job, I run the TFI New Media Fund. And what I've had to do with the guidelines for that, for example, is just try to keep it very, very open, but make it very clear that we are looking for artist-led projects that bring a sense of vision and a sense of craft to them. So we try not to draw the boundaries around what it is, but I think in terms of the intention, we try to make it clear that that's still what we're looking for. We are still the Tribeca Film Institute. So, you know, that's very important to our mission. Unfortunately, I think with some of the projects, it's a case of we'll know it when we see it, and it's very, very difficult to put that into writing.
And that was the Tribeca Film Institute's Ingrid Kopp, bringing this edition of the program to a close. Our other guests were Kat Cizek, Nick Doherty, and Kate Nash. And the question we now have for you is, what do you think constitutes a documentary in this multi-platform age? Tweet us your thoughts or use the comment function on our webpage. Just search RN and Future Tense.